climate summit in Dubai, in the United Arab Emirates, this is Democracy Now!
The people of Gaza are in the midst of an epic humanitarian catastrophe before the eyes of the world. We must not look away.
The UN Secretary General has invoked Article 99 of the UN Charter for the first time in decades to press the Security Council to support a ceasefire in Gaza, warning public order is completely breaking down as Gaza's humanitarian system collapses from the Israeli assault. We'll speak to the award-winning Palestinian poet Masab Abu Toha, who was recently jailed and beaten by Israeli forces. He's joining us in his first interview since leaving Gaza. Then, this is a cabal of oil producers, not a climate summit. That's what climate scientist Kevin Anderson says about COP28 here in Dubai.
I refer to the COP as a cabal of oil producers. And I've used that expression because year after year at these international negotiations, the most powerful voice is not that from the US, from the EU, from China, or any other country. It is actually from the oil-producing companies.
We'll speak with the Nigerian climate activist Nima Bassi here at the UN Climate Summit as well.
It is a breaking point for the African continent. It's a moment when real climate action should be taken and not carbon trading.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli tanks have advanced into the center of the city of Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip as Israel's assault in the besieged Palestinian territory enters its third month. On Wednesday, an Israeli strike on the Jabalia refugee camp killed 22 members of the family of Moman al-Sharafi, a correspondent for Al Jazeera Arabic, including his parents and his siblings. Palestinians in parts of southern Gaza that Israel's claimed are safe continue to come under fire. This is Amir Magnum, a 5-year-old boy injured Wednesday when an Israeli strike hit a school in eastern Khan Yunis where his family was sheltering.
I went into the classroom and went to play with my friend. Then suddenly I heard a sound going boom and ran. A rock fell on me, on my legs, and then I ran away.
Who got injured?
Father. A big rock fell on father, hit him here on the leg, and a big rock fell on me, here on my leg.
Gaza's health ministry says Israeli attacks have killed more than 16,200 people, more than 7,100 of them children. In a new report, the World Food Program finds at least 97% of households in northern Gaza have inadequate supplies of food to meet their needs. A third of residents of southern Gaza reported high levels of severe or very severe hunger. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, a Reuters investigation has revealed an Israeli tank crew killed one of the Reuters journalists and wounded six other reporters on October 13th by firing two shells in quick succession from Israel while the journalists were live streaming cross-border shelling. The attack killed Reuters videographer Assam Abdullah and injured six others, including Agence France-Presse reporter Christina Assi. Reuters has condemned the killing and is demanding Israel explain its actions. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has invoked Article 99 of the UN Charter in a bid to force a debate at the Security Council on a resolution calling for a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. Guterres spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric announced the move Wednesday.
Secretary General urges the members of the Security Council to press to avert a humanitarian catastrophe, and he appeals for a humanitarian ceasefire to be declared.
It's the first time Guterres has invoked Article 99 since he became UN Secretary General 7 years ago, just the fourth time in UN history. In New York City, medical workers with the French charity Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, held a candlelight vigil outside the United Nations headquarters Wednesday, calling for a ceasefire in Gaza as they honored colleagues who've been killed by Israel's assault on hospitals and clinics. Four MSF staff members are among the hundreds of medical workers that have been killed in Israel's attacks since October. This is Dr. Africa Stewart, an obstetrician and chair of MSF's board of directors.
We speak out now because you cannot deliver humanitarian aid while you fear for your own life. I'm here for the mommies. I'm here to remind us how hard it is to run full speed when you're pregnant, how debilitating it is to decide if you're going to hold your toddler's hand or a parent's hand as you flee. Our colleagues are being killed at the bedside of our patients. This must stop. We need basic perinatal care, which includes water and food and electricity.
In the United States, senators blocked a procedural vote Wednesday on a $111 billion emergency supplemental bill to provide military aid to Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel. Every Republican voted against the package after party leaders argued the bill didn't go far enough toward further militarizing the U.S.-Mexico border. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders also voted no. At the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, a gunman killed three people and wounded a fourth on Wednesday before he was fatally shot by police. The suspect has not been named, but is reportedly a 67-year-old career professor with connections to colleges in Georgia and North Carolina. Las Vegas is the site of the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history after a gunman killed 60 people at a 2017 music festival. Former Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said Wednesday he's resigning from Congress at the end of the year. McCarthy's planned departure comes 2 months after he became the first House Speaker in U.S. history to be removed by members of their own party. Under California law, a special election must be held in about 4 months' time to decide who will represent McCarthy's district in California's Central Valley. His departure further shrinks Republicans' slim majority in the House after lawmakers voted last week to expel New York Congress member and serial fabulist, that's liar, George Santos. In Alabama, just four candidates took part in the fourth Republican presidential primary debate Wednesday evening. Donald Trump again skipped the debate, holding a fundraiser instead. Host Megyn Kelly set the stage for an unabated attack on transgender youth. Here she questions former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who opposes trans health care bans, citing parental rights.
Surgeries done on minors involve cutting off body parts at a time when these kids cannot even legally smoke a cigarette. Kids who go from puberty blockers to cross-sex hormones are at a much greater likelihood of winding up sterile. How is it that you think a parent should be able to okay these surgeries, never mind the sterilization of a child? And aren't you way too out of step on this issue to be the Republican nominee?
No, I'm not. Because Republicans believe in less government, not more, in less involvement with government, not more in government involvement in people's
Other
lives.
Other candidates took host Megyn Kelly's bait to attack trans rights and cite medical falsehoods, with businessman Vivek Ramaswamy calling transgenderism a mental health disorder. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis had this exchange with former Trump UN ambassador Nikki Haley.
If you're somebody that's going to be the president of the United States and you can't stand up against child abuse, how are you going to be able to stand up for anything? That is the truth. We have it on video.
I said that if you have to be 18 to get a tattoo, you should have to be 18 to have anything done to change your gender.
You said the law should stay out of it.
Meanwhile, front runner Donald Trump appeared in a Fox News town hall Tuesday night, where he told host Sean Hannity he would not be a dictator if he becomes president again, quote, other than day one. He also told Hannity his priorities would be to close the border and drill, drill, drill. In related news, Georgia prosecutors have put former Vice President Mike Pence on their possible witness list in their sweeping 2020 election interference case. In Peru, former President Alberto Fujimori walked free from prison Wednesday after the Constitutional Court ordered his release on humanitarian grounds. The 85-year-old Fujimori had been serving a 25-year sentence since 2009 for the murder of 25 Peruvians during his rule in the 1990s. This is Gisela Ortiz, former culture minister of Peru and the sister of one of the victims of the 1992 Cantuta massacre, in which death squad members disappeared and murdered a university professor and nine students.
As relatives of massacre victims, we demand for the law to be respected. Law is equal for everyone, even if your last name is Fujimori. The processes and paperwork must be followed. If he is entitled to a pardon, this will be proven, but we don't want for our right to justice to be mocked, for years of hard work from relatives to be stomped on because everything is part of a political arrangement.
The legendary television producer and longtime political activist Norman Lear has died at the age of 101. In the 1970s, Norman Lear helped revolutionize TV sitcoms with a string of hit shows, including All in the Family, Sanford and Son, The Jeffersons, Good Times, and Maude. Lear's social and political activism earned him a place on Richard Nixon's enemies list and the scorn of the Christian right. In response, he founded People for the American Way, a progressive advocacy group in 1980. This is Norman Lear speaking in a 2016 interview with Democracy Now!
I think it was H.L. Mencken who once said, nobody ever lost money underestimating the intelligence of the American people. To some degree, the establishment lives with that and makes its decisions on behalf of the American people with that in mind. I disagree. I think, we are provably not the best educated, but we're wise of heart, and we understand a lot more than we're given credit for.
And today is Noam Chomsky's 95th birthday. To see our interviews with the world-renowned scholar, linguist, and activist on Democracy Now! About Israel, Palestine, the climate crisis, and so much more, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has invoked Article 99 of the UN Charter for the first time in decades to press the Security Council to support a ceasefire in Gaza as Israel intensifies its assault, which began 2 months ago today on October 7th after Hamas attacked Israel. In a letter, Guterres wrote, quote, amid constant bombardment by the Israel Defense Forces and without shelter or the essentials to survive, I expect public order to completely break down soon due to the desperate conditions, he wrote. He went on to write, quote, we're facing a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system. The situation is fast deteriorating into a catastrophe with potentially irreversible implications for Palestinians as a whole and for peace and security in the region. Such an outcome must be avoided at all cost. We begin today's show with the celebrated Palestinian poet Mousab Abu Toha, who was recently jailed and beaten by Israeli forces. He was detained at a checkpoint in Gaza as he was headed toward Rafah with his family. He was rounded up with scores of other Palestinians. After he was released from an Israeli jail 2 days later, Abu Toha posted a message on social media writing, quote, I am safe but still have pain in nose and teeth after being beaten by Israeli army. I gave them all my family's passports, including my American son's, but they didn't return anything. Also, my clothes and my children's were taken and not returned to me. No wallet, money, credit cards, he wrote.
Mousab Abu Toha's detention sparked global outcry from the literary community and beyond. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Progressive, and other publications. He founded the Edward Said Library in Gaza. His first book of poetry, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, won the American Book Award and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. The poetry collection was published by City Lights Books. On Sunday, Mossab Abu Toha managed to leave Gaza with his wife and three children through the Rafah border. He joins us now from Cairo, Egypt, for his first interview since he was jailed. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mossab. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm sorry for all you have gone through. Can you describe what happened, where you were detained, where you were jailed, what happened to you when you were in Israeli prison?
Thank you so much for having me. I made it from the north of Gaza to the south of Gaza, but I was jailed by the Israeli army. I was trying to cross and reach the Rafah border crossing. Our names were listed by the American, by this Department of State, because my youngest son, 3 years and a half, was born in America. He's an American citizen. So I was trying to cross from the north of Gaza, where I spent the past 2 months, I would say, to the south of Gaza, where Rafah is, and where we were advised to go. But at the checkpoint, I was picked by the Israeli army, along with about 200 other people. I was picked by the Israeli soldier. He called me by describing me. He said the man with the black backpack and the red-haired boy, put the boy down and let him go and come to me. So I took our passports, my son's and also my wife's and two other children, thinking that I would show the passports and also my American son to them, so they would just let us go. But I was surprised because he ordered me very aggressively to put the son down and come to join the queue of other people who were kidnapped with me. I mean, there was a younger man. He was so scared, and he said, "I wanted my mother. I want to be with my mom. Oh, my mom, come help me, etc." I tried to calm him down, telling him, "Oh, don't worry. Maybe they are going to ask us some question, and then we would go." But that was not the case. I was then summoned by another Israeli soldier, who was sitting next to another soldier who was pointing his gun at us. They asked us to recite our names and our ID numbers. And then I was led to another Israeli jeep, in front of whom, I mean, there were three Israeli soldiers. I was forced to take off all my clothes. I just took off my pants and my shirt, etc., and I kept my boxer shorts on. But I was surprised when they asked me to just also take off my boxer shorts. So I was naked. I felt humiliated. I felt terrified and terrorized by this army because they were ordering us to do everything at gunpoint. And then I was beaten in my face. I was beaten in my stomach. And I still have pain in my face. And later I realized they were taking us to Be'er Sabah or Be'er Sheva, about 2 hours away from Gaza, without knowing what they were going to do to us. I had little clothes to warm my body during the cold weather. And then they took me for interrogation, and I did tell them all my story. And I wasn't aware that the whole world, especially in America, were just writing about me and asking for my release. I think this was one reason. I mean, I didn't do anything in my life. I didn't harm any person, although I lived under occupation all my life. And I was wounded when I was 16. I got a piece of shrapnel just a few centimeters away from my windpipe. So I was harmed. My house was bombed. But I myself didn't harm anyone. But I was harmed again. And I'm still harmed by the fact that my family and my neighbors are still in Gaza. And the last time I was in touch with my mother and my sisters, and also my brothers and their children, was 5 days ago, the same day I left Gaza. So I have no single piece of news whether they are alive or dead.
So Musab, I'd like to ask you, I mean, of course, you mentioned very soon after you arrived in Egypt that you remain very, very concerned because your parents and your siblings are in Gaza. You've not been able to reach them for 5 days. Are you able to reach others in Gaza? I'd just like to read very briefly what a leading military analyst from the U.S. has said, drawing an analogy between the Second World War's bombardment of German cities like Dresden and Cologne and the contemporary present bombardment of Gaza by Israel. This is Robert Pape writing, Dresden, Hamburg, Cologne, some of the world's heaviest ever bombings are remembered by their place names. Gaza will also go down as a place name denoting one of history's heaviest conventional bombing campaigns. So, Musab, if you could talk about that and what you know now about what's going on in Gaza since you left.
Well, I mean, the situation, I think, is different than the other place names that you mentioned. For your information and your respected audience, I still have friends whose houses were bombed a few weeks ago and whose bodies are still not retrieved. And I wrote in one of my posts that not only are we in Gazans concerned about being killed under the rubble of our house, but also of being alive under the rubble and no one coming to rescue us. So there are no fire trucks, there are no civil defense staff, there is no fuel, there is no equipment to retrieve the bodies of those who might be still alive under the bombing of their house, after the bombing of their houses. So I don't think Gaza could be compared to any other place on earth. And now with social media and all the world watching us, I mean, it's different from maybe Second World War. I mean, people would hear the news of the bombing of a house or something, maybe later. But people are just watching us live, and no one can step in to stop the carnage, the genocide that is committed against my family, my neighbors, my friends, my students, my fellow writers, and artists. So during the truce, a few weeks ago, I think 2 weeks ago there was the truce, I was in Deir al-Balah, in the other half of the Gaza Strip, while my brother Hamza, who is the father of three children and whose wife is pregnant and is about to give birth, so that's another issue that no one talks about. I mean, the reality and the circumstances with which women in Gaza are living. I mean, they are talking about sexual violence against Israeli women, but no one talks about the violence against our lives. No one talks about women, pregnant women. No one talks about women themselves buried under the rubble with their families. So this is not called violence. So you just care about sexual violence. That's all you care about. Miserable how this world is really thinking.
And Musab, so could you talk about that?
Stop.
Could you
and
say?
You need to.
Musab, I was saying,
yes.
If you could elaborate on that, what
Hello?
The situation of Palestinian women in particular, as you pointed out, Palestinian women who are pregnant, given what the situation in hospitals is. You've said a little bit about this in the past. If you could elaborate. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you know, women, just in, like other women in the world, I mean, women in Gaza have their own needs. I mean, there are no clean bathrooms. There are no clean toilets. And they need their own things, you know, when a woman gets the period. I mean, there are no stuff for them to take care of their bodies. And there are also the other pregnant women. So Many hospitals in Gaza are out of service right now, not only for the wounded, but also for the pregnant women. No one talks about this. You need to talk about this. Where can my sister-in-law, my brother's wife, where can she give birth? And is there enough clothes for the newborn baby? So you don't care about this violence committed against parents? How they are going to manage their lives? No one talks about this. This is violence in itself, not only killing us, but about, so it's also about the lack of water, the lack of food. You know, before the start of this carnage, we used to buy 25 kilo of wheat flour for 40 shekels, which is about $12. Yesterday, my wife's uncle messaged me and he said, I paid 500 shekels, which is about $130. So he paid $130 to get 25 kilograms of flour wheat flour. But, and if you could find it, of course, because there is lack in respect to wheat flour and other basic things. But so if he had the money to buy it, there are other people who had not been able to get any money because they are jobless. Most people in Gaza depend on daily jobs, farmers, sellers, etc. So there are the majority of people in Gaza don't have money. So they are sometimes begging other people to give them money. So no one talks about this. They are just talking about sexual violence. They are about October 7th. But this has been going on even before October 7th, by the way.
We are reporting on everything, the horrific stories we're hearing from October 7th, but also what happened before October 7th to Palestinians and after. And I wanted to get your response to the World Health Organization calling the assault on Gaza humanity's darkest hour. The UN's top humanitarian relief coordinator said Israel's attack in southern Gaza has been as devastating as in the north, with the apocalyptic conditions preventing the delivery of aid, some 85% of the population now displaced. And particularly if you could talk about your conversations with doctors and nurses in Gaza. You tweeted, just imagine yourself as a father watching your child not only having his, her leg amputated, but also dying of pain. Do you still feel you're a father? That there are still humans in the world? Talk about the hospitals.
Mm-hmm. So the first hospital I was able to enter was Shuhada al-Aqsa Hospital, which is in Deir al-Balah. And I went there. I mean, I don't like to go to hospitals because, first of all, there is no space for me to enter. I mean, full beds are full of patients and wounded people. And at the same time, the corridors, the inner hallways are just full of people lying there. I mean, wounded people are getting treated, getting surgeries while on the floor. So, but I had to go to the Shuhada al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah to get some treatment for my face and my bleeding nose. So there are not enough doctors to treat the patients and the wounded people. And there are just bodies everywhere. People even, I mean, they would just go and bury people without their relatives around because their relatives have died with them, which is really, really heartbreaking. People are turned into numbers and names. They would just put a body in a piece of cloth and just write their names and that's it. They would just take them to the cemetery. So I was able to talk to some doctors and nurses at the hospital, and I was shocked. I mean, I knew that there were not enough medications, but I was told by one nurse about the case of a child who had her leg amputated, and because there was no anesthesia, no painkillers. The child died while she was having her leg amputated. And I'm wondering, how would I feel as a father if my child had to have her leg or arm amputated while she is watching her arm or leg amputated?